Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And I don't know what you got out of the GOP debate last night. I found myself pitying the people who had to caption it and make transcripts. But here is one of the relatively rare coherent statements made last night about an important issue of the day. Here is Senator Ted Cruz arguing that in the legal standoff between Apple and the federal government over unlocking a cell phone belonging to the San Bernardino terrorists, it is Apple that should blink.
Apple should be forced to comply with this court order. Why? Because under the Fourth Amendment, a search and seizure is reasonable if it has judicial authorization and probable cause. In this instance, the order is not put a back door in everyone's cell phone. If that was the order, that order would be problematic because it would compromise security and safety for everyone.
But maybe the issue is not quite as simple as candidate Cruz would have us believe. It is clear cut, though. Here is Apple CEO Tim Cook speaking to ABC News, and then listen to FBI Director James Comey testifying before Congress.
This case is not about one phone. This case is about the future. What is at stake here is, can the government compel Apple to write software that we believe would make hundreds of millions of customers vulnerable around the world, including the U.S.?
Law enforcement, which I'm part of, really does save people's lives, rescue kids, rescue neighborhoods from terrorists, and we do that a whole lot through court orders that are search warrants, and we do it a whole lot through search warrants of mobile devices.
Privacy versus security. On Thursday, Apple filed a formal opposition to the federal court order requiring it to help law enforcement break into one of those phones a day before today's court deadline to respond. The federal government has also asked for the company's help in unlocking 9 additional phones. So where does this fight go from here? Joining us is Nuala O'Connor, former chief privacy officer for the Department of Homeland Security from 2003 to 2005. She's currently the president and CEO of the Office of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a nonprofit focused on advancing a free and open internet. This case, she says, couldn't be more important.
Technically, what we're talking about is the request from the government is to undo the password lock feature, right, and to create new code. The code does not exist right now. It is a precedent that could send a signal that the government can ask a company to break end-to-end encryption, to break other security and privacy protections in their devices. I think it's an outrageous overstepping on the part of the government.
All right, let's extend on this argument then. In the case of Verizon and AT&T and some of the Snowden revelations that they cooperated with the government on domestic surveillance of phone metadata, if the interior of your smartphone is known by Apple, or the capability is knowable by Apple in any way, does that mean the government has access to it? Or does Apple have to make the point that, no, this is not known and not knowable because that's what our encryption does? We have no idea, and we do not have the capability to actually break into a phone without committing a crime.
Well, that's what the goal is with strong end-to-end encryption, is to make it so that even the device manufacturer, the device offerer, can truly simply not see the data, that the data is jumbled or created or obfuscated or masked in a way that only you as the end user get to see it. That's where we're headed, and I think that is a concern that some people say, well, the government should have the key or the government should be able to break it. Encryption is a tool and a protection that other countries and other device manufacturers will create and will use as well. So on one hand, you're asking an American manufacturer to break its own encryption. Don't you think, you know, people who have ill intent or who want to mask their activities or use devices to in the course of doing bad things will not be able to find encryption in other countries or find devices in other countries and use them? I think asking one manufacturer or one country's manufacturers to defeat their own protections is actually, again, harming national security, harming our economy, and most fundamentally harming our individual rights. And I think I'm so glad you brought up Snowden, because it's in the same class of overreach by the government and also the blurring of the lines between the private sector and the government sector about our data. And that to me is one of the most compelling threats and the most significant trends that we need to fight against if we're going to live in a truly always-on digital world where our devices serve us and not the government.
In your experience, both working in the public sector and the private sector, you've basically had a front row box seat to the inability of government to stay ahead of the curve of technology. And I'm wondering if there's a clock ticking on whether this issue is going to be soon out of date and that Apple may be able to hold back the dam, you know, hold back the water now, but eventually there are going to be workarounds to all of this stuff, and that this little dust up will be perceived, you know, 10 years from now as a legal asterisk.
Well, I don't think of it right now as a little dust up, but I take your point that it is a skirmish in a larger kind of battle between the rights of the individual and the rights of the state about ourselves and our data and our daily lives. I take your point that we really need to get to a principled place where I believe the rights of the state should be very limited in intruding in our daily lives and in our data, and that the technology is really not the driver, but the larger principle of one's own dignity, one's own safe space, one's own zone of privacy is what drives. The one good compelling bell that I hear is the Supreme Court has ended up in the right place in the last four or five technologically driven cases, Kylo, Riley, Jones, and others, and they have upheld the rights of the individual against law enforcement intrusion into new and emerging technologies. And so I'm hopeful, although, again, we're about to see a change in the court again, but I'm hopeful that the justices will continue to hold the line that the rights of the individual are paramount to the rights of the state, and only with a very clear, compelling, limited, public interest reason would there be an intrusion into, again, your vie quotidienne, your daily life.
Nuala O'Connor is a former chief privacy officer for the Department of Homeland Security from 2003 to 2005. Currently, she's the president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a nonprofit focused on digital civil liberties. Nuala, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
The Apple case is just one on the Supreme Court docket that might be affected by a court in turmoil and that might have only eight justices until well into next year. The White House leaked a possible name this week to fill the vacancy left by the death of Justice Scalia, a Republican, Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval, but then he removed himself from consideration. With us is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, has the White House signaled that it's drawing the Republicans into kind of a setup, that it will continually raise names of moderate, even conservative justices and force the Senate to be obstructionist here and then work that into the election?
Well, John, I think you've put your finger, I think you know where this is going, which is the opening gambits in a game of three-dimensional chess that is shaping up between Senate Republicans, President Barack Obama, and the presidential race. And it is multi-level with risks and benefits all over it. First, the throat clearing, give you an idea of how all the players are approaching the three-dimensional chessboard here. Harry Reid says the Republicans will cave. They will eventually hold a hearing. They will consider a nominee because we will put so much pressure on them. Mitch McConnell says there's not a snowball's chance in hell I'll cave, his words that he used in a meeting with Republicans. And then Judiciary Chairman Charles Grassley, who we're going to listen to here on the Senate floor after Harry Reid threw some insults his way too.
Yesterday, the minority leader came to the floor to disparage the work of the Senate Judiciary Committee and also disparage the work of the Senate as a whole. And of course, as he does from time to time, He launched into a personal attack against me. Childish tantrums aren't appropriate for the Senate.
Well, tantrums are one thing, but senators worried about their own reelection is something else.
Yeah, they sure are. And we've talked time and again about the Senate Republicans who are up for reelection in states that Barack Obama won, in blue states or purple states. They are people like Ron Johnson in Wisconsin or Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania. Mark Kirk of Illinois is one of the Republican senators who has said, I disagree with McConnell's strategy. I will meet with an Obama Supreme Court pick if that person comes up to the Hill. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, the moderate, said the same thing. But the politics is complicated. Look, there's a benefit here of saying we're not going to let the liberal, unpopular Barack Obama change the ideological tilt of the court for a generation. That makes sense for Republicans. But there's risk all over it. The obstruction, John, you mentioned it. Who is Barack Obama going to nominate? Not just anyone. He's going to nominate an avatar for Democrats' election aspirations, right? Somebody that makes Republicans look obstructionist and mean if they refuse to even meet with that person. They don't want to have a hearing. They want to avoid the spectacle of a hearing. Everybody remembers hearings like Clarence Thomas or Robert Bork. The public pays attention. Republicans might seem like they need to be really, really tough on that person. Maybe Ted Cruz is on the campaign trail, raining down purity on this entire process, making it impossible for those Republicans who need flexibility to have any. I asked Rob Portman, he's a Republican, he's running for re-election in Ohio, which Obama won twice, about the politics of this, and yeah, it's complicated.
No, I really, you tell me what you think. I mean, I think it's very difficult to know that. I think you do what's right, and let the politics sort themselves out.
Well, it seems like the politics are sorted. The White House holds all the cards here. The White House can actually propose a conservative justice. The Senate can obstruct. And then if the Democrats win the White House, the expectation is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to retire. And so they still get a liberal justice to nominate.
John, you're good at three-dimensional chess. I think maybe you've considered this. They could do that. Look, it's unlikely to have such kind of acute gambit as nominating a conservative. I think what you're likely to see is that avatar of the aspirations of Democrats, of liberals, that person that can be a rallying cry for the re-election camp, for the election campaign of Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or whoever the Democratic nominee should choose to be. And also the idea from Democrats of Senate dysfunction. Look, John, there's an argument over how much precedent is involved here. You guys did it. No, you guys did it. But we really should put a fine point on this. It has been at least 140 years since a Supreme Court nominee has not had a hearing or a vote. And the Senate here really is scraping the bottom of the barrel when it comes to dysfunction. Regardless of whose fault it is, this really is the bottom of the barrel. And I asked Lindsey Graham how bad this has gotten, whether this is payback for all the fights of the last 10 to 15 years over judicial nominees and obstruction. Listen to Lindsey.
I felt completely betrayed. You're not going to screw me over and ask me to do you a favor that is really not consistent with the traditions of the Senate.
That's amazing.
Completely betrayed. He says Lindsey Graham voted for Sonia Sotomayor, voted for Elena Kagan. He says not this time.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Today, we name a champion in our search for America's greatest innovation. Along the way, we encountered so many amazing creations. There was the hearing aid, Kevlar, the electric guitar, the programmable robotic arm, the 3D printer, the air conditioner, GPS, the mobile phone, the sewing machine, and your wise pick that I was always secretly rooting for, I have to say, the transistor. But I have no vote in this contest. It's all been about you and your votes, hundreds upon hundreds. You rush to thetakeaway.org to have your say. The final three innovations are the sewing machine, the mobile phone, and your pick, the transistor. We'll announce the winner shortly. But first, a quick nod to our partner in this series, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Tom Laughlin is their executive director. He's a dear friend of The Takeaway. He's a firm believer in the power of innovation to keep our infrastructure safe and to keep America moving forward.
I think innovation has always been with us. I mean, you go back to the Egyptians trying to move water. It was innovation trying to solve problems. It was man's ambition to do big things, to make the world a better, safer place with more utility, to improve the quality of life. It just goes hand in hand with innovation.
And what does the ASME do in terms of monitoring innovation and, you know, keeping track of the safety of, you know, all the stuff that we don't pay any attention to?
Right. So we at ASME follow innovation as it finds its way into society. And we as engineers think about the public safety and the application of that. So in the middle of the 19th century, steam was discovered as this ubiquitous source of energy. But it would have problems. I mean, it would create explosions. And the engineering, insurance, and manufacturing industries got together and said, you know, there's got to be a better way. And through collaboration and discussion, the standards came about. The idea that we can codify best practice, understand what was causing these explosions, and contain it, fix it. And as a result, steam explosions went to zero, and now we have pressure equipment in our home, whether it's your home boiler or your toilet for that matter, and it's not going to blow up because of standards and because of that public safety. And so now as the world has gone on and you have the rapid evolution of technologies, standards have to keep up, and it's a big challenge for organizations like ours.
Is that collaboration that you described there, engineers getting together with insurance people and public safety officials and deciding that there needs to be standards, that technology can't just run roughshod, it can't just all be Steve Jobs in the garages, there has to be some sort of strategy brought to the table?
Standards really do two things. One is it provides a common language. The idea that you can manufacture component parts for a nuclear power plant in China and install them in Pakistan. The other is about safety. And that comes sometimes after the fact, sometimes after a disaster. So for example, in the Deepwater Horizon event in the Gulf, that was at the cutting edge of technology. That was at incredible depth, incredible pressures, things that hadn't really been seen before. Standards don't exist yet for that. The industries are doing the best they can to conform and ensure public safety. But because they're at the cutting edge of that technology and it may be proprietary, public safety sometimes comes not second but isn't always top of mind as opposed to getting to market.
Now, you know, when I think of innovation, I think of no standards, no constraints, that you're thinking out of the box. You're running away from all of those traditional institutions. And you say that, in fact, you can't do that without compromising public safety.
Right. So if you think about innovation, it often isn't these big, huge breakthroughs. It's usually applying adjacent technologies, or it's usually kind of taking it to the next level. So looking at the collection of finalists in your innovation series, many of those came about through evolution. They weren't just kind of this – the cell phone didn't show up just one day. It was a progression of technologies to the point where now there are more than 5 billion cell phones on the planet. The same thing with the sewing machine was an evolution. And so the idea that the most cutting-edge technologies achieve these kind of breakthrough status when there's sociology and technology kind of merge.
What's the joy in this? I mean, there's this kind of get-rich-quick, lightning strikes in one place sort of story that goes along with the Steve Jobs and the Thomas Edisons of the world. But if you spend any time at the ASME, this is a quiet, dedicated priesthood of folks, some of whom may have difficulty telling a joke, some of whom may have difficulty understanding a joke, but still, this is a crucial piece of how things get done and why things don't blow up.
Yeah, it's true. There's a reverence and a sense of this audacious responsibility that comes with standards development. The idea as we as engineers just are thrilled to death by technology and the idea of how it might transform and improve the quality of life. And it's all possible that we can have clean water and ubiquitous energy and adequate and safe food supply. But standards are going to be at the root of it, and there's going to be organizations like ASME are going to be there all along, understanding the importance of standards, understanding that it can be done, understanding that, yeah, when things happen, we can learn from that and make it better. And so the joy comes from the seeing the technology and innovation applied to improve the quality of life and just think about it. Think about how jazzed up people are getting about these innovations on your show. I just am thrilled by that and appreciate the attention that it's getting. And not just by engineers, but everyone who kind of – we're all kind of live immersed in technology this day and age.
Tom, it's always great to talk to you. And I just always get enthused about your passion over all this sort of stuff. And, you know, I'll go home and maybe fix that drawer in my kitchen.
Well, thanks,
my
John.
Wife's bugging me.
If you need help, I can refer a couple of engineers to help you. And thank you for your time and attention. Thank you so much for giving for celebrating innovation. It's the American and it's the human endeavor. Thank you.
Tom Laughlin is the executive director of the ASME, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. So as we said, we're down to three in our search for America's greatest innovation: the sewing machine, the mobile phone, and your nomination, the transistor. Of these, the greatest impact on our culture, our economy, our way of life came from, according to your weeks of voting, America's greatest innovation is the transistor. Congrats to all of you wise technovator, commentator, judges, and voters. Let's explore one of the early transistor-driven disruptors, the transistor radio. Small, portable, perfect for low-fidelity AM radio. Easy to carry single records. Each contained two songs, but the transistor radio contained all songs, or anything the DJ was willing to play. Steve Greenberg is the Grammy Award-winning founder of S-Curve Records, known for such hits as Who Let the Dogs Out by Baha Men and Stacy's Mom by Fountains of Wayne. Steve is also the author of How the Beatles Went Viral in 64, and the transistor was partly how.
When Top 40 radio started in the 50s, which really happened because television had become popular and all the other kinds of programming that was on the radio at the time became economically unfeasible. And so stations turned to playing records, which was the cheapest form of programming. The thing that really caused the format to take off was the popularity of the transistor radio, because suddenly the audience was not only bigger, but it was everywhere. Kids listened to the transistor radio in two different ways when they wanted to listen to it privately, right? One was they would put it up to their ear real close, the same way that we would hold a cell phone to our ear today. And then also there was the earplug.
Right, not an earbud. It was the earplug.
Right, because AM radio was in mono, you only needed one earplug in one of your ears to hear the whole program.
And your dad owned headphones.
Yes.
If he did it all.
But the earplug was great because, of course, you would take the transistor radio into bed with you at night,
right,
and you could listen to music without your parents knowing. And that was the first time the kids were able to do that.
What bands particularly benefited from the AM music fast iteration model that really transistor radios created?
Well, I mean, certainly the whole rock and roll revolution in the 50s benefited from the existence of transistor radios, because all of a sudden, you know, not only could kids listen privately in their room at night, but they also could take the radio with them everywhere and listen with their friends and create this musical community. So they could listen in the schoolyard or at the beach or in the park or wherever they were with their friends. And that was a new kind of behavior that didn't really exist before. Before, if you wanted to listen to music with your friends, you either did it at home or you went somewhere where they had a jukebox. The band that really most benefited from the transistor radio was the Beatles.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand.
One of the luckiest things that happened to the Beatles was that I Want to Hold Your Hand was released on December 26, 1963, which is significant because the most popular stocking stuffer gift of 1963 was the cheap transistor radio. And so all these kids got transistor radios on Christmas morning 1963, and Capitol Records released I Want to Hold Your Hand the next day.
And they bought the single on the 27th.
Yes.
They were holding hands by the 28th, and New Year's Eve,
everybody was listening to the song
over.
at every New Year's Eve party. In fact, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand actually sold 250,000 singles in the first 3 days.
Do you think every mobile audio device since then is an echo of that original transistor radio? The beatbox, the Bluetooth speaker, the all kinds of things that are available today.
Yes, but what the transistor radio had that was unique is that it actually enhanced both the public listening experience and the private listening experience. And most technologies before or since enhanced one or the other. The boombox was public.
Right.
The Walkman was private. The transistor radio was both.
Steve Greenberg, Grammy Award-winning founder of S-Curve Records, author of How the Beatles Went Viral in 64. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you.
The people have spoken. The transistor is officially America's greatest innovation.
Support for the search for America's greatest innovation is provided in part by the Lemelson Foundation.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And at the 88th Academy Awards on Sunday night, host Chris Rock and everyone there in the largely white audience will have some splaining to do. 2 years in a row of all-white acting nominees, very little acknowledgement of anyone else not white. How will the winners reference this controversy or avoid it altogether? Remember Sean Penn winning for playing the gay politician Harvey Milk back in 2009?
You commie, homo-loving sons of guns.
Rafer Guzman, our film critic and film critic for Newsday, looks back at the Oscar speeches that did it best.
Anyone who's given a toast at a wedding knows the best way is to be clear, be brief, and be gone. For years, those were pretty much the rules at the Academy Awards.
The thrill of this moment keeps me from saying what I really feel. I can only say thank you with all my heart to all who made this possible for me. Thank you.
Grace Kelly accepting her Oscar for The Country Girl in 1955. Back then, acceptance speeches were short, gracious, and never political. Even when Sidney Poitier became the first African-American to win as leading actor for Lilies of the Field in 1964, he opted for understatement.
Because it is a long journey to this moment, I am naturally indebted to countless numbers of people.
Poitier named a few people involved in the film, and that was it. But by the 1970s, the speeches started to sound a little different. Marlon Brando opted not to accept for his performance of The Godfather's Don Vito Corleone.
Hello, my name is Sasheen Littlefeather. I'm Apache, and I'm president of the National Native American Affirmative Image Committee. I'm representing Marlon Brando this evening, and he has asked me to tell you in a very long speech, which I cannot share with you presently, that he very regretfully cannot accept this very generous award. And the reasons for this being are the treatment of American Indians today by the film industry. Excuse me.
Overnight, Littlefeather's moment in 1973 became one of the most controversial in the history of the awards. 2 years later, a documentary filmmaker, Bert Schneider, spoke out on the Vietnam War.
It is ironic that we are here at a time just before Vietnam is about to be liberated. I will now read a short wire that I have been asked to read by the Vietnamese people.
That went over like a lead balloon with the show's host, Frank Sinatra. He came out and read a letter from the Academy, apologizing for those remarks. But that was nothing compared to the reception Vanessa Redgrave got in 1978 when she jumped into the Israel-Palestine issue.
And I pay tribute to you, and I think you should be very proud that in the last few weeks you've stood firm and you have refused to be intimidated by the threats of a small bunch of Zionist hoodlums whose behavior is an insult.
These days, we kind of expect an Oscar speech to address current affairs and political issues. When Michael Moore picked up an Academy Award in 2005 for his anti-Bush documentary Fahrenheit 9/11, you just knew it was coming.
We live in a time where we have fictitious election results that elects a fictitious president. We live in a time where we have a man sending us to war for fictitious reasons, whether it's the fictitious of duct tape or the fictitious of orange alerts. We are against this war, Mr. Bush. Shame on you, Mr. Bush. Shame on you.
Well, if the Iraq War seemed like a hot-button issue then, imagine what the topics of race and racism will do to this year's Oscar speeches. And here's a wrinkle. The Oscars are trying out something new called the Thank You Scroll. It's a list of names submitted in advance that will zip across the bottom of the screen. It's supposed to leave more time for the winners to say something else with their 45 seconds. And you can bet they will. If this weekend's Oscar winners are looking for a role model to follow, then my nomination for Best Speech would go to a silent star, Charlie Chaplin. He received an honorary Oscar in 1972 and finally spoke after a 12-minute standing ovation.
and words seem so futile, so feeble. I can only say thank you for the honor of inviting me here. Thank you.
Not reporting from the red carpet, this is Rafer Guzman for The Takeaway.
They get the picture? You laughing now?
He's not a monster. He's a great guy who worked for us for many, many years.
Cut him off.
You ought to be grateful I can still afford to pay your salary.
Check out the big brain on bread.
I'll send you a nice box of Christmas meat. Best I can do. Get out of here.
And you can do anything, right?
It's Friday, it's movies, and the winner is Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Rafer.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Academy.
That's right. Very good. So we've got the Academy weekend coming up. We've got a couple of movie releases. Eddie the Eagle. Let's listen to a clip here. I'd never heard of Eddie the Eagle. It's an interesting story, and listen.
So is this the bit where you say I told you so?
No. This is where I say that without the booze, I wouldn't even have the guts to do that, John. As your coach, I think you're crazy.
I don't know what I was thinking.
But as your friend, I say you gotta do it. This is your moment.
I need a practice jump.
What do you need to know you don't know already? It's higher than you jumped before. You're gonna go faster than you've ever gone before. You're gonna fly farther than your tiny little brain can handle, but it's just a jump. Yeah, simple.
1988 Olympics, Winter Olympics.
Right.
I should know this, but I don't.
Well, he was Eddie the Eagle, played by Taron Egerton there. He was a British ski jumper, became the only guy to represent his country there in the ski jumping. And basically, he was a no-hoper, self-funded, self-trained, and wound up setting a not very impressive record, but a record nevertheless at the Winter Olympics. And this movie is a very lighthearted, fluffy, kind of feel-good, kind of Billy Elliot style movie. It hits every nail on the head, and I have to say it's really charming and really fun. Taron Egerton is great as Eddie the Eagle, and that's Hugh Jackman you're hearing there as his coach, who is, by the way, fictional, a completely fictional character
they made
up for the movie, but he's still a lot of fun because, you know, Hugh Jackman is always great.
Well, if you're going to have a fictional coach, it should be Hugh Jackman.
Exactly. Yes. He almost makes him seem real.
999, what's the premise here?
Good question. It's about a bunch of crooked cops and some criminals who are kind of in thrall to the Russian Israeli Jewish mob. They have to pull off a nearly impossible heist of breaking into a homeland security compound if one of them wants to see his son again. And the way they're going to do this is by killing another officer and bringing all the cops to that scene while they go off and pull their heist.
Impenetrable, but with some very familiar names in the cast.
It's an amazing cast. Chiwetel Ejiofor, Kate Winslet plays the villain. She's actually quite good. Casey Affleck, Woody Harrelson, the list goes on.
How's your job going?
You know,
spend my time trying to make a difference.
You gotta make a difference.
You ain't gonna make a difference.
Your job, out monster the monster, and get home at the end of the night.
Does this add anything to the genre?
Well, not really. I think what this film has, and I'm hoping it's accidental, is the problem is that people who would get together and pull a heist and kill a fellow officer in order to pull that heist off don't, to me, seem like the heroes of a film. And so it's very difficult for me to care whether that heist goes off because the entire time I think, you know, I think your kid would be better off without you. So I don't really care what happens to any of the people in this film, and I'm not sure why the filmmakers thought we would.
Although you said the guys in The Big Short weren't sympathetic, and I loved that movie.
And you loved that movie.
I loved that movie.
All right, let's test your morality and go see this one, John.
So Christianity is over. We've moved on to Egypt now in Hollywood, Gods of Egypt.
That's right. You've got Gerard Butler as a god named Set. He wants to take over all of Egypt. There's a mortal named Beck who is going to team up with the god Horus, and they're going to try to battle him and see if they can keep him from turning the world into darkness.
Will Egyptologists grimace at this movie, or is it authentic in any way?
I don't think it's authentic in any way, especially when you hear Gerard Butler's vague Scottish burr as the Egyptian god.
Of course.
What do you want?
Immortality.
Immortality awaits us all in the afterlife.
I don't want to die. I want to live forever.
Where are they going to put all of those British speakers in the afterlife?
That's, yeah. That's Jeffrey Rush there as the sun god Ra. I wish you could see him because he delivers every line with flames sprouting out of his skull. This movie is fun in parts, but not enough of a campy treat to recommend.
Well, not a bad weekend of offerings leading up to the Oscars on Sunday night. You've got Eddie the Eagle, 999, and Gods of Egypt. What about Deadpool? Though, I mean, R-rated movie,
R-rated
and $135 million on the first weekend.
It was an unexpected smash hit. And, you know, I don't think anyone saw this coming. I despised the film. I loathed it. I thought it was a self-satisfied, offensive, snarky, childish little movie that was trying to mock the superhero genre and get you to sort of mock it with it.
And your point is?
I just
more, yes.
Yeah,
more
I was really surprised at how well this film did. I don't think anyone thought it was going to do so well.
Is it an outlier, or is there something about the sort of, shall we say, sexual improvisations of the Deadpool character that lead us to a new world here? Is there something...
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've got two kids, and what I'm always looking for are superhero movies that I can take them to. They're 7 and 5 and 8 and 5, excuse me. And, I'd like to take them to see, let's say, Ant-Man, Iron Man, things like this. You certainly can't take them to see Deadpool.
Although Iron Man sets us up for R ratings in the superhero genre, it seems like. It seems like they're hinting at we could go farther with this.
Because they're a little suggestive,
yeah.
a little racy.
Well, Gwyneth.
Right.
First scene in the first Iron Man, the bedroom scene, as I recall.
That's right. So, that's not exactly kid stuff. I'm not quite so sure why the superhero genre feels like it needs to go into the R rating and be an adult film genre, really. I've always found them much more enjoyable as sort of a kid tween kind of genre. I mean, that's just me. I hate to think of, Superman going R-rated. I hate to think of Wonder Woman going R-rated.
Well,
I can only
think of 135 million reasons why it would want to go
in that
direction. What will you be doing when you're watching the Oscars this weekend?
I will be at the office in front of a computer. I'll have a television on one side, my keyboard in front of me, an editor yelling at me over the phone, and that'll be my Oscar night.
Well, here's a note from your audience. Adam from Michigan says, personally, I would still hope that Michael Keaton would be nominated and rewarded for his performance in Birdman last year, and the fact that he wasn't nominated for Spotlight this year makes me feel there is a conspiracy going against Michael Keaton. You would go along with that, I bet.
There is some hope. He's starring in a movie called The Founder, where he plays the founder of McDonald's, Ray Kroc. I have high Oscar hopes for that.
Charlotte, North Carolina, the movie Spotlight should win because it tells the truth about a situation most people didn't believe existed. I saw that last weekend. Absolutely amazing.
Great
weigh in
movie.
With your picks. Number is 8778 My Take, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend, Rafer.
Thanks. You too, John.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and for The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
Okay, we will do... Oh, shoot.
For all of her too short life in music and the 20th century's cauldron of change, Nina Simone posed the question, what's happening?
Hey, we're in the middle of a revolution, because I see the face of things to come. Yes, I see. Oh, oh, the more. Ain't it hard just to live? Just to live.
It was a revolution in music and politics, and it seemed to erupt from Nina Simone's mouth in words and sound, no matter what she was singing or playing.
Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day, will I run to?
Those two songs by white composers, Randy Newman's Baltimore and Les Baxter's Cinnamon, Details. Everything else came from deep inside one of the most influential musicians of the 20th century. The question, what happened, Miss Simone, is a quote from the late poet Maya Angelou. It's the title of a documentary up for an Academy Award. As they say at the Oscars, Jason Jackson, producer. He's a longtime music manager, worked with the likes of Lauryn Hill and other big, intense, successful artists. But he speaks of the making of this film as something like a religious experience.
She's a mythical figure in the artistic and activist community, but I was always attracted to some sort of humanity in her story somewhere, and that's sort of what set me off on this whole journey.
There's a soundbite in the film where she says, and this is during the peak of her activist period, "My art is going to reflect my times." Mm-hmm. And she says it with a look of just, this is obvious. Doesn't everybody mm-hmm. understand this? What was her crossing of the threshold, do you think, in the story?
Really interesting. And that was one of the more amazing things that came out during the research for this film and actually reading her diaries that she wrote down about her life. She felt a particular distance from the civil rights movement for a long time because she was born and raised in the Jim Crow South in a small town called Tryon, North Carolina. And though it wasn't the crucible of Jim Crow, she certainly felt it and talks about it in the film where she says the railroad tracks literally divided the town black and white. She felt like racism and discrimination was always going to exist and complaining about it was really going to do nothing. But she felt differently when she became older and the Alabama church bombing of the four young black girls happened. That's literally when I think she was thrust into the movement. And, you know, her exact words were, "I wanted to pick up a knife and go outside and hurt people."
When the kids got killed being that church, that did it. First you get depressed, and after that you get mad. And when these kids got bombed, I just sat down and wrote this song. And it's a very moving, violent song, because that's how I feel about the whole thing.
Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam.
That's the turning point, and actually when she wrote Mississippi Goddam.
Nina's daughter describes that everything fell apart, that riding this wave, this artistic wave, was a journey to complete chaos. How do you understand that, and how do you see that in the film?
You see her throw herself into the civil rights movement, not just literally through her art, but figuratively. It was something she couldn't stop thinking about, really. And it's a tough thing to reconcile when you're doing so well professionally, particularly as a person of color during that time period. But most of the people that look like you in the country are having hard times and don't even have access to gainful employment, and they're discriminated against on a regular basis. So I think it planted the seed of a kind of paranoia that only really successful artists can understand and contemplate. And I think we still see that today, even in contemporary times. I have to say, you know, Beyonce's Formation video just released recently is an example of that. I mean, who would have ever thought an artistic statement would cause police departments nationally to refuse to provide security to a pop star? So it's just as interesting now as it was then for artists who step out.
And again, it is a stepping. You step into these waters, and it's a very dangerous place. You've experienced the work of Lauryn Hill, right?
Yes, sir.
It's kind of the same story.
It's very, very interesting. You know, I actually met Nina Simone while working with Lauren on tour in Paris in 1999, and I wasn't even aware of who Nina Simone was. But her presence was so large and strong, and she came in and cleared our dressing room. The interesting part is I was looking at Lauren's mom, who was with us, and was like, who is this woman that, you know, Lauren is responding so strongly to? And I realized her mother was in tears. And she said, that's Nina Simone. She was the soundtrack to my life. And that's sort of what began my journey of finding out who she was and her importance to people of color here in America.
Why is it so obvious that she knows the difference between what's authentic and what's self-serving? Because there's not an inauthentic moment that you ever see on screen in this documentary.
Yeah. And Ambassador Shabazz, Malcolm X's oldest daughter, I think she sums it up at the end of the film where she says, you know, Nina lived more honest than most people are. I don't think she had the ability to filter her thoughts or her emotions. And in the world of art and music, it played out wonderfully. And we obviously all loved it and enjoyed it. But in the regular world, it sort of became a hindrance for her because she really didn't have a filter and didn't know how to make people feel good about the things she was saying. She just felt a particular way and let it fly.
There's a musical moment in this film that just turns me around and around. And I'm going to read the lyrics. I say when he died, he told me all my life, he said, keep on working.
I said when he died, he told me all my life. He said, keep on working, girl. They open up the door. One of these days, you won't have to wait much longer. Just tell him exactly how you feel. So I'm gone.
So powerful.
I mean, who's speaking there?
And I'll tell you an interesting story about the tribute record we made. I asked Lauren to cover that particular song. So she went up to the ubiquitous YouTube and found the original song, but the original song is very different than how Nina performed it. And I was like, yeah, but I think if you do it the way Nina did it on camera, it would be a really, you know, powerful moment. And she said, Jason, that's the spirit right there. You can't cover the spirit. That's her. That's the essence of who she is in the way she delivered that song. And I was like, I kept saying, no, but you can do it like that. And she was like, no, I cannot do it like that. Only Nina Simone could do it like that.
Jason Jackson, what a delight speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Jason Jackson is a producer of What Happened, Miss Simone, also a producer of the tribute album. He spoke to us from Los Angeles.
One day I woke up and I could fly. I looked down at the sea. And I wouldn't know myself. I'd have new hands. I'd have new feet.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Don't start any revolutions this weekend, or go ahead. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.